WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, tightening our borders. As the country braces for new terrorist attacks, is it time for radical immigration reform? First, consumer confidence slumps again. The New York-based Conference Board reported today that its Consumer Confidence Index was at its lowest level since 1994. I spoke earlier today with Lynn Franco, director of the Conference Board's Consumer Research Center, and asked her how the numbers add up.
Consumer confidence has plunged to 85.5. We've seen a severe erosion in our present situation component, and the expectations component also took a dive. So consumers are telling us that current economic conditions have eroded significantly, and they're very pessimistic about the short-term outlook.
Where were those who watched these numbers expecting them to come out?
I think most folks were expecting these numbers to come out in the mid-90 range, and it's well below that level.
And for those of us who don't know what all the different categories of question are, take a step back with us. How's this consumer confidence survey put together? What kinds of questions are asked?
Well, we ask five questions. We ask consumers to appraise the current situation regarding business conditions and employment. Those two questions yield what we call the present situation index. Mm-hmm. Then we ask them their expectations 6 months out regarding business conditions, employment, and income. And those three questions yield what we call the expectations index. Both of those are very weak, and in fact, the overall level of expectations is at levels that we see prior to or at least at the onset of a recession.
So this goes back to the mid-90s, or how long has it been since consumer confidence was this low?
We go back to 94. It was at 79.9, so we're kind of approaching that kind of 80, which is the recessionary level.
And that 94 would be back in the last recession.
Yes, the recession was over, but it wasn't until the unemployment rate began to steadily decline that we saw an uptick in consumer confidence. And here, too, it's the rise in the unemployment that's driving confidence down.
The holiday season is coming up. Is there a pattern of what you expect to see in your numbers as that approaches? Does it usually pull numbers up or drive them further down if people are uneasy?
Well, if people are uneasy, we expect kind of a further decline in the figures. And given where we are today as opposed to where we were a year ago, there's been kind of a dramatic deterioration. So we really don't expect a blockbuster season.
Several things are going on. People are trying to revive the economy. The Fed has cut interest rates 9 times this year. Has that had any effect that shows up in your numbers?
Not necessarily. A lot of times consumers have already anticipated these cuts, so it's kind of built in. The key is the labor market. And as we see, you know, with the layoff announcements in the hundreds of thousands and those yet to come, it doesn't look like confidence is going to turn around anytime soon.
And what about the stimulus package working its way through Capitol, across Capitol Hill? I realize you don't ask specifically about that, but I guess you don't also see much bump from it here.
No, again, that's, kind of on the back burner at the moment. And, you know, what we're seeing right now is kind of an immediate deterioration in conditions, you know, an unemployment rate that's kind of moving upward and is expected to continue along that path. And therefore, that's going to kind of hold confidence down.
Consumer confidence has been seen as the last big pillar holding the economy up to the extent it's been held up. If that's gone away, what are the implications?
Pretty severe. There's no way then that a recession is avoidable.
What are the patterns that history shows us about how long it takes consumer confidence to come back? Is there any standard period of time? And I guess these are not standard times in any case.
No, and confidence will go as the labor market goes. So if we continue to see an uptick in the unemployment rate, we're going to continue to see a negative impact on confidence. Until labor market conditions turn around and consumers feel much more secure, then we'll see an uptick.
Is there room for further fall here if you look back across patterns you've watched over time?
Oh, yes. We've had consumer confidence dramatically much lower. When we take a look back at prior recessionary levels, we'll see that confidence dips into the 50s and 40s. So it still is, a good 40 to 50 points off some of the lows that we've seen, but it's come down, you know, substantially over the course of the past year.
When we look at the last recession, when we had the last president, George Bush, what kind of levels were we looking at?
Very dismal levels. We were in the 60s, 50s, 40s. And then as in the mid-90s, as we began to see kind of an improvement in the labor market, that was when we saw an improvement in consumer confidence.
And what was the peak during the big bull market and boom economy of the 90s?
Oh, it reached 144.7 twice during the course of 2000. In May and in January, and then it's kind of been downhill since.
And today it's 85.5, is that right?
Yes.
Wow, big drop.
Yes.
Lynn Franco is director of the Conference Board's Consumer Research Center. I spoke to her earlier today from her office in New York. President Bush today announced a crackdown on foreigners who have overstayed their visas in the United States. This from a president who just this past summer wanted to grant legal status to undocumented workers from Mexico. But after September 11th, it seems a case of closing the barn door a little too late. America has 31 million foreign-born residents, at least 6 million illegal immigrants, 500 million entries at the nation's borders and ports every year, and too few overwhelmed INS workers. That math, some experts say, works out to wonderfully for terrorists. Are America's borders too open? Will the threat of terror mean a revolution in U.S. immigration policy? Joining me now is Stephen Camerata. He's director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Stephen Camerata.
Good evening.
Also joining us is Jake Tapper, the Washington correspondent for Salon.com. Hello, Jake Tapper.
Hello, how you doing?
Well, thanks. Can America crack down on immigration and remain the global meeting place? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Steve Camerata, if we could turn to you first, what is the problem here?
Well, in terms of illegal immigration, the problem is twofold. One is that there are two ways to be an illegal immigrant in the United States. And the word undocumented or illegal alien are all, I'm going to use them interchangeably
okay.
here. In any event, one is you can come in legally and then on a temporary visa and then overstay, it's called. You overstay your visa. That is, you come as a student, a tourist, a guest worker, cultural exchange, what have you, and then you don't go home when you're supposed to. And the other way is to, in a sense, sneak across the border. It's called entrance without inspection in INS parlance. INS is the Immigration Service. And so we think that there are about 8 million illegal aliens in the United States. The latest Census Bureau estimates indicate. And we think that about 40% of that 8 million are people who overstay their visas, and about 60% are people who sneak into the United States. And the key problem here is that if 8 million people can live in the United States with little difficulty, then a terrorist who wishes to do so, certainly it would indicate, would face few obstacles. The bottom line is if now clearly the vast majority of that 8 million are not terrorists, but it certainly suggests that we've really kind of lost control of our borders.
But in the wake of September 11th, when we had foreign terrorists who pulled off such an attack, there's concern about much more than just undocumented and illegal visitors or residents in the United States, is there not?
No, right, exactly. Obviously, some of the terrorists, we think three of them at least, were in the country illegally at the time they committed the acts. That is, those three had overstayed their visas. And there were six more that we're just not sure. They may have snuck in or they may have overstayed their visas, but we're just not sure how they got into the country. So, yes, part of the concern here is that a failure to enforce immigration law may make life a lot easier for people who are terrorists and, you know, wish to do us a significant harm. And so that's why you're seeing various proposals in Congress to have more stringent background checks on each visa applicant, because at least 10 of the terrorists were in the country legally at the time of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously we missed something in their background. And also there's a lot of talk about establishing what's called an entry-exit system. That is, we would actually know who comes in and who goes out of the country. At present, it may seem surprising maybe to your listeners, but we don't record entrances very carefully, and we especially don't record departures. So although we issue about 7 million time-limited visas each year, We don't keep track to know whether those time limits are actually being honored. And so one of the reforms that's being talked about is to actually start keeping track of that.
Which means the U.S. government doesn't really know who's in the country at any given time.
Exactly. At this point, if the FBI goes to the INS and says, hey, we've got this guy, we think he's a terrorist, is he in the country? The INS's response is, boy, wouldn't we like to know. Mm-hmm. And I think that the thought is that that's got to change.
Jake Tapper, what is the mood in Washington right now about immigration? It's long been seen as a source of strength in many quarters for the United States, but after September 11th?
Well, I mean, there's been a sea change. Things that were, remember, President Bush had been reforming and changing the face of the Republican Party, and one of the ways he was doing that was by embracing Mexican immigrants, discussing amnesty, as you mentioned in your introduction, mm-hmm. for some illegal immigrants, and obviously playing up his relations with Mexican President Vicente Fox. The days of questioning the porous borders were gauche. People like Pat Buchanan and protectionists from Union State.
Mm-hmm.
And that is now all completely changed. There are vast, in the anti-terrorism bill that passed last week, there were vast changes implemented into law. Senator Kit Bond had introduced a number of these measures before. A lot of individuals in the Congress had introduced these measures before, but they had been stymied. A guy named Lamar Smith, a Republican congressman from Texas, after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, he was stunned to find out that one of those World Trade Center bombers had gotten a student visa, had come into the United States, had dropped out, and then just stayed. And he was stunned. And this is in 1994. He proposed a complete change in this, and the law, in fact, mm-hmm. passed, but it was stymied, and funds for it were withheld. And in fact, one of the people that was most responsible for getting this law so hamstrung in terms of its implementation mm-hmm. was the current Energy Secretary Spence Abraham, who is from Michigan.
And why?
Spence Abraham is a big proponent of immigration. There are probably a couple reasons. One is he's a big supporter of business, Chamber of Commerce types. They supported that sort of thing. Spence Abraham is also an Arab American, has very close ties with the Arab American community in Michigan. And they, as were plenty of ethnic groups in the United States, were in favor of more open borders and more open immigration for student visas, et cetera.
Stephen Camerata, I want to ask you, are we in danger of going after a relatively small number problem, that is, as many as there may be, there are not millions of terrorists here, with a sledgehammer when we apply these rules to the entire immigration scene, or is that necessary somehow to build the net to catch the terrorists?
Well, I guess in some sense all, you know, security measures are always directed at the tiny fraction of the population who means to do a great deal of harm. In other words, everybody's bags are x-rayed and everyone goes to a metal detector on a plane, not because many or most of the people getting on the plane intend to hijack it, but simply because there's one in a million who will. Well, it's the same with immigration enforcement. Though in the case of immigration enforcement, obviously anyone who overstays their visa has in fact committed a crime, and I think there's general consensus that we don't want that. We want people to abide by rules, and a nation that prides itself on being based on the rule of law, we're going to need to make sure that people honor the terms of their visas. If you say you're going to leave in 6 months, you got to leave in 6 months. If you'd like to for a visa for a year, then that's what you ought to apply for. And I think that there's a general increasing recognition that makes sense. So putting aside the terrorist question, I think it's perfectly reasonable to track people when they come and go and to make sure that they're honoring their visa obligations. I think in general there's a new the events have given, I think, the public the public always seemed to be in favor of immigration enforcement. The people who weren't were primarily the business community and a lot of ethnic advocacy groups. But now I think that they're sort of hanging back, and they accept the fact that there's going to be a greater attempt to have an enforcement, including, you know, more Border Patrol. And
Steve Camarota, we've got to take a quick break. Jake Tepper, hang on, please. We're talking about immigration and tough new measures being implemented and being proposed to make it much more difficult to get into the United States and to stay here without being tracked. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you ready to pull up the drawbridge? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. WBUR. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. immigration policy under fire since the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York and Washington. There are a lot of proposals on the table now to tighten immigration, make it much tougher to get in and stay in the United States invisibly. We're joined this evening by Stephen Camarota. He's director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, an independent Washington, D.C.-based think tank that looks at the impact of immigration on the United States, and by Jake Tapper. He's Washington correspondent for Salon.com magazine. Jake Tapper, there's a big range of proposals on the table right now and steps that have already been taken. What's been implemented already, and what else is being proposed to tighten up immigration?
Well, a number of things were signed into law last week. They were in a bill from Senator Kit Bond, and they were absorbed into the Anti-Terrorism Act. One of them tracks student visas, foreign students who get student visas. One discusses, expresses the sense of the Congress that there should be more of an exit-entry system, and the president has formed a task force for that. Another one talks about machine-readable passports. It's a start. It's not, as I'm sure the other guests can better describe, it's a start. There needs to be a lot more done. For instance, there are a lot of individuals in Mexico who have special electronic passports who and those passports are there for them to more easily get into the United States. The problem is the INS is so underfunded, they don't even have the special machines to read those passports, read those electronic passports.
Not much point then, is there?
Right. They're also, I mean, look, there was a two of the alleged hijackers were here on student visas and apparently didn't go to any sort of school whatsoever. One of them, Hani Hanjour, got a student visa to come into the United States and go to a school and just didn't go, didn't show up.
Two out of the 19, and what were the immigration status of the majority of the rest of the alleged terrorists?
Well, it's funny, you know, they all had 12 of the 19 of them, according to a study I did, could have, if INS had been functioning as theoretically it should, 12 of the 19 could have been snagged in one point or another. And it breaks down like this. Two of them, including Muhammad Atta, could have been denied entry because they had already in previous visits violated their visa status. So you're allowed to be denied. You're allowed to deny somebody re-entry into the United States if they have prior visa violations, and that right was not exerted in this exercise. In this instance, six of these individuals were denied. Should or could have been denied entry because they were apparently using completely false names. These are the six people that we still are not quite sure who they are. Three of them could have been tracked down before September 11th. There's overlap in some of these categories, by the way, but three of them should have been tracked down before September 11th for staying longer than their visas allowed them to. Two of them got student visas, didn't even show up for class, and two of them had been admitted into the country and then showed up on an FBI watch list, and they theoretically they could and should have been tracked down by INS agents. The problem is the INS only has 2,000 individuals to track people down.
So there are big issues of both capacity and legislative wherewithal to keep track of immigrants in the United States. We're going to get into that in a minute with Jake Tapper and Stephen Camarota. We have a lot of callers who want to join us as well, though. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about U.S. immigration policy in the wake of the September 11th attacks. There's a big move on to tighten up. What do you think of that? Renato is on the line. Welcome, Renato. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, what about immigrants that are willing to die for this country, you know? They came here with nothing. They even though they don't have the right status to stay here, they ended up staying, and mm-hmm. they build a life here. Some of them buy, you know, house, they grow family, and which is my case. And
what's your home country, and how did you come, Renato?
Well, I came here when I was 18. Today, I'm an American citizen. Mm-hmm. I'm 31 years old. I'm going to be 32 years old next week. And I have a daughter here, and this is my country. You know, this is my daughter's country. And just like myself, I know a lot of other people that came here. It's about the same time, and they still don't have any legal papers to stay here, but they ended up staying. And they're willing to die for this country. You know, what do you do with these people?
Well, Renato, were you ever out of legal status in the process of becoming a citizen?
Yes, I was.
And I guess under these new proposals, the idea is that you would have been found out and sent out of the country.
Okay, but what do we do with the people that are here right now for 15 or 18
mm-hmm.
years?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they live here, they have home here, they consider the United States their country, even though, you know, they're not here on a legal status.
Got it, we've got it. And as you say, they have real loyalties, or may have. How about it, Stephen Camerata? Renato raises from personal experience this path that he came. He wasn't always legal. He's a citizen now, and points out that there are many others still on that path. Are we talking about sending everybody home, or is it something more subtle than that?
Well, people who would like to see the laws enforced would make the general observation that we think that about 100. Here's some numbers for you. We think there are about 8 million illegals in the United States. We think that number grows by 450,000 a year. We think about 150,000 go home on their own each year, about 50,000 get deported each year, and about 200,000 actually do get legal status. They marry an American, they win what's called the visa lottery, and so forth, so they qualify for legal status. So in other words, there is, if you will, an out-migration from the illegal population of something like 400,000 a year. It's just that another 400,000 or so on top of that come in, so the population continues to grow. In other words, about 800,000 people enter illegally each year, and about 400,000 leave the illegal population each year for a net growth of about 400,000. So if you wanted to enforce the law, what you could do is simply dramatically reduce the number of people coming in by going after the employers who hire them and by having a lot stronger border patrol, and then even only modestly increase the numbers going out, and the problem would take care of itself over time. That's if you prefer a kind of a law enforcement solution. The problem with granting legal status is that it, in the past when we've done that, given out what's called amnesty, it seems to have encouraged a whole lot more people to come in illegally. So we're stuck in this problem of, well, somebody may have successfully violated the law and lived here for 15 years, and I think people can have some sympathy for that. The problem, as soon as we start making an exception for that person, we end up with 8 million illegals.
But until September 11th, there were a lot of people who stood up and said, you know what, all in all, this is to the economic benefit of the country to have people here, even people who are potentially illegal. George Bush himself was ready to grant a more legal status to lots and lots of Mexicans, saying these are an asset to our country. Has that changed?
Well, the thing of it is that there was always a huge debate. The National Academy of Sciences has probably 3 years ago came out with probably the most definitive study on immigration. And their basic conclusion was that immigration was neither a boon or a bust to the U.S. economy, that the benefits and the costs have been grossly overstated. In his new book that came out called Heaven's Gate, the nation's leading immigration economist, George Borjas mm-hmm. from Harvard, an immigrant himself, basically summarizes those arguments. You can't make an economic argument for immigration. You can make all kinds of other arguments that, look, gives people a chance to share in the abundance of life in the United States. It's part of our tradition. Those arguments seem to me fine. But in general, economists who look at this question, we come to the conclusion that it's just not a big boost to the U.S. economy, and you can make a case that it's actually a modest drain to the economy. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have immigration. It just means that if you're going to justify it, you probably need to look elsewhere.
And now there's a new element, the security element, and
it's
moving
right.
A lot of legislation along. We're talking about U.S. immigration policy after September 11th and the kind of changes that are in the works that promise to substantially tighten up. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andy is on the line. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, thank you. I think the point was probably already made, but since I've been waiting so long, I'll just try to make it.
Fire away.
It seems to me almost the immigration sort of question is really not disingenuous, but isn't very precise. I mean, the issue really isn't, hardworking, loyal immigrants. It's the subversives that are the issue. And, I think that's really the question. I don't think immigration is the issue. I think if immigration is to be part of the issue, then I think one would hope there'd be greater attention to detail as to who's coming in and from what countries of origin they originally originate from. And if those countries, to not be too politically incorrect, if those countries are suspicious or rogue nations and or, are on a terror list or something, then that must be much more greatly attended to. But
We got your point, Indy. Let's put it to Steve Camerata, and thanks for your call. Steve, what about this? How fine a tooth comb would be produced if all the proposals on the table get implemented? Will we be much more capable of sorting out exactly who's coming in, and what's our capability now?
Is relatively limited. I mean, it's very complex, but basically the proposals involve sharing and use of more sophisticated tools in identifying potential terrorists. If keep in mind that in the case of these terrorists on September 11th, these folks mostly came from Saudi Arabia, in some ways supposed to be a U.S. ally, so they're not a nation that we consider to have sponsored terrorism, so we can't use that kind of criteria.
Although, if I could interject for one moment.
Jake Tepper.
One thing that's very interesting is that one of the proposals that they're trying to get enacted in the United States right now is to get passenger lists ahead of time from planes coming from overseas to the United States. And Israel has exceeded, a whole bunch of countries have exceeded, most of the European countries have. Egypt and Saudi Arabia still refuse to give the United States their passenger lists ahead of time.
So what do we learn from that? Even if we change our laws or procedures, if we don't have cooperation, it won't really be effective in terms of the security interest in immigration reform?
Well, I think we could do a lot more. The point is we don't have to let somebody in then. If the point is that when he gets off the plane, if Saudi Arabia or Egypt won't cooperate, that's unfortunate. But the point is when he gets off the plane, if he's on some kind of list or that he doesn't look right, we think that, his past behavior suggested he's an enemy of America, we can put him back on the next plane.
Can we do that now, Stephen Camerata? Do we have a legislative authority now to put someone back on a plane just because they're a quote-unquote enemy of America? What does that mean?
Yes and no, in the sense that if somebody's on a terrorist watch list, but we can't charge him with a crime in the United States, we do, the INS does have the discretion to simply put him back on the next plane to his country. But it is also true that if you advocate the violent destruction of America and the death of all its citizens, but have not done any act to carry that out or raised money, you simply, distribute bin Laden videos and chant his name all day. We, at present, the U.S. law allows you into the country, because the way it works is that if those opinions would be permissible by a U.S. citizen, then they are permissible by someone coming into the country. So that probably needs to change. We probably need to exclude all those people just as a matter of prudence.
There's a lot on the table, a lot being talked about in terms of changes. We're talking about U.S. immigration policy in the wake of the September 11th attacks. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Sita is on the line. Welcome, Sita.
Hi. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm attacking this from a different angle, I guess.
Okay.
I'm somewhat for, the measures that you're talking about taking. I was originally from Turkey, and I moved to this country, had a green card, got my citizenship. My parents were involved in that. I've been a citizen since. My boyfriend is from Syria, and he moved to this country legally when he was 14.
Okay.
On a student visa, and he kept the student visa through college, finished college, started working for a company that has sponsored him, and it's been 6 years. He's spent about $10,000 on lawyer's fees, and he still has another 2 years before the green card is a possibility for him. And, this poses a problem for a lot of people who have come here, have been educated, and want to stay in this country because they love this country. It's their home. But, they have to go through this process. And, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of money. The INS does not make it easy.
You're saying there's already a lot of bureaucratic red tape, and it sounds like there may be more coming. Sita, thanks for your call. Jake Tapper, what about that? People who come legally, want to pursue citizenship, and find it just an overwhelming bureaucratic problem.
Yeah, and it's a shame. I mean, my heart goes out to her when she was telling that story, because obviously Syria is a country that the United States considers to be a state sponsor of terror. Although Prime Minister Tony Blair is, I think, in Syria as we speak, trying to encourage them to become more part of this coalition against terrorism.
But here's Sita's boyfriend, who is not interested in that, apparently. He wants to come and work. He wants to stay and work. Can we tighten up and also make it more streamlined for people who do not emerge as potential terrorists, but rather as potential good citizens?
Well, I mean, here's the rub, is that you know, of the 1,000, more than 1,000 individuals that the Justice Department clearly has in detention because of the investigation, the events of September 11th, you know, I'm guessing that 90% of them, if not more, have absolutely nothing to do with this. They just were caught in the web of immigration and, you know, possibly some small criminal activities, and also being, you know, let's be honest, there's ethnic profiling going on here.
In the dragnet, and that's kind of a big signal being sent right there. Owen is on the line. Welcome, Owen. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm an immigration attorney. I practice in Boston. Mm-hmm. I've been practicing immigration for over 10 years, and I find the conversation pretty interesting, and, you know, I don't want to say informative, because a lot of this I've heard plenty of times before, but interesting. Some of this I'm just finding hard to swallow, though, because I'm specifically the enforcement angles of it. Those people placed into deportation proceedings right now have so many fewer rights than the people placed into normal criminal proceedings.
Are you talking about the 1,000 that have been
to a crime?
You think you're talking about the 1,000 who have been swept up in the dragnet after September 11th, Owen?
No, actually, I'm talking about the everyday person. I'll just give you an example. I was in court today with a Tiananmen Square organizer who lost his asylum claim, even though we could show the bullet wounds.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up going in front of a judge. He did get his green card, married to a U.S. citizen. It took 3 years to get to that stage.
Mm-hmm.
They question the validity of the marriage when there's a child involved. They question whether this person had the right to be here whatsoever. 3 years to get something that he should have been able to get very quickly, very easily, upon proving the torture, etc. Now, when somebody is placed into deportation proceedings, they have no right to the rules of evidence. They have no right to discovery. In other words, you don't have the right to know what the government has against you.
Right. We've got it. We're coming up on a break, Owen, but we've got your point that it's not easy. And what about this, Stephen Camerata? On the one hand, we're saying it's too easy to come into this country. On the other hand, Owen is telling us firsthand, look, it's rough out there. If you're in a difficult immigration status, you can be treated essentially with few rights or protections.
One of the reasons that's happened, though, is unfortunately immigration attorneys have abused the system so much. We know that hundreds of thousands the people apply for asylum, especially prior to reforms in the mid-1990s, who had no ability to claim it. They simply did it as a way of forestalling deportation. We had 10,000 people from Mexico apply in 1 year. And so we had to make these changes because the system was being so badly abused, and there seems there's no way around it. Unless we have sort of clear-cut, tough rules, then the alternative is that then we get in a massive backlog of asylum applications, and people simply use that as a way of staying in the United States.
Stephen Camerata, we've got to take a quick break. It sounds like those tougher rules may be on their way right now. We're looking at immigration policy and reform of immigration policy in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. A lot of changes coming down. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. immigration policy in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. In the interest of bringing greater security to the United States, major changes are in the works for how immigrants come into the U.S., how they stay here, and how they're tracked while they're here. Do you think that clamping down on immigration is an effective way to guard the United States against terrorism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lewis is on the line. Welcome, Lewis. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello.
Good to have you, Lewis. What's on your mind?
I was coming home And first of all, this is my first time I call a radio station in my
okay.
life.
We're glad to have you. What's your story or your question?
I will try my best because my English had been in school only 1 year.
Sounds great.
And I did that to try the visa, and I couldn't get it. I was reported, so I stopped school. I had to start working, take care of my life. What I want to say is I've been here for 13 years in this country
mm-hmm.
as a legal person, and it's been very hard. I left my family. 5 years later, I lost my father. I didn't leave this country.
What's your home country, Lewis?
Portugal.
And
Europe.
And have you been working and living illegally in the United States all
yes.
that time?
Yes, and very happy with this government, with this this country.
As an illegal...
They know where I am,
mm-hmm.
and they don't come get me.
They do know where you're working, but to date they haven't come.
I'm sure.
To...
I'm sure because I get the IRS, papers,
mm-hmm.
because my name doesn't match the Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
So they know.
So can you imagine a future in which the law gets much tougher and you may be sent back to Portugal after this time ends?
I want to go back, and I don't want to go back. I don't know. I tried 10, 12 years ago, I tried. Didn't work as a student
mm-hmm.
because I came as a contractor,
mm-hmm.
working across, tourist cruises,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
big boats. And I quit for 4 months because it was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to come. I have a brother in Massachusetts, and I decided to come and stay.
Lewis, we appreciate your story, and we can hear how difficult this is. People invest their lives in these major moves, legally or illegally, and you've done that. Jake Tapper, these aren't just numbers on a big scorecard in Washington. These are our real lives. Does that get taken into account here, or is that getting washed away in the concern over security and tightening up immigration laws?
Well, I think that... I think that there are, you know, if you're a member of Congress or a member of the Senate, then you do hear these stories on an individual basis, and I'm sure that a lot of members of Congress do recognize the serious hardships that a lot of individuals go through. But, you know, that said, there are 2 to 3 million people in this country, I believe. Steve can correct me if I'm wrong on the number, but 2 to 3 million who have applied to become legal
mm-hmm.
Immigrants. And have not, and are waiting their turn and are waiting in line. And that's a daunting number, 2 to 3 million, but that's a smaller number than the number of individuals who decided to not respect the laws of this country and come here have come here illegally.
Mm-hmm. Yet another knock-on effect of one day of terror running into lots of people's lives. We're talking about reform of U.S. immigration policy in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Barry is on the line. Welcome, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a little nervous.
Don't be nervous.
Okay. I have a question, but first I wanted to say that I think it would be really sad for this country to lose a lot of the immigrants that
mm-hmm.
are here. Most of my friends are immigrants, some of them legal and some of them not. And I find they're a greater asset to this country, and they appreciate this country a lot more than people who were born here who don't even do anything with their lives.
But Barry, let me ask you, with that attitude, what do you think, in the wake of September 11th, what if tightening up on immigration is necessary to increase our security? Is that a worthwhile trade-off?
Well, I think that obviously things have to change, but I would hope that it would not eliminate all of the wonderful people that I know and that are here, and that maybe greater investigation could go on, but not not greater enforcement, if that makes sense.
Well, because I guess you're suggesting we want to really find the people who are terrorists or potential terrorists. You had a question, Barry.
Yes. I wanted to know how it works in other countries. Are they stricter? Do they fine people faster? Do they go after people, like in Europe or in Asia, Arab countries, you know, in different places of the world?
Right. We got it. It's a great question. Thanks very much for your call, Barry. Stephen Camerata, how about it? In let's say, European countries, or you choose the example, how do immigration policies on enforcement and awareness of who's in the country and who's exited compare with those in the United States?
Well, I want to respond to her first comment very, very quickly and say that, well, right now we're not talking about reducing the number of permanent or temporary visas given out. We're still presumably going to be giving out 800,000 or 900,000 permanent residency visas. That's for the people who then can eventually become citizens, and 7 million temporary visas, as well as over 10 million people who come in on what's called the visa waiver program. So no one's really, as of yet, making the case that we lower all those numbers, though people probably will in the future. We're just simply talking now about enforcing the law. On the question of other countries, it's very clear that the United States has some unique problems when it comes to immigration. Not only is it a very attractive destination, it's a big, free society, but we share a border with a third world country with huge income and lifestyle differences in the two countries. And so that creates a huge, we think that of the 8 million illegal aliens in the United States, we think that probably around 4 or 5 million of them are from Mexico. So that looms very large. But other countries face a similar challenge. It's just that they have more orderly societies, a little better documentation. But certainly Spain, for example, is experiencing a lot of illegal immigration from North Africa. Greece, a lot of illegal immigration from the Middle East.
Stephen Camerata, let me ask you in particular, how do countries keep track of resident aliens, I guess is the term, when they're inside the country, but between formal contacts with the government or the law or the exit point? That seems to have been an issue in the case of the September 11th terrorists and with many others. Are there ways that countries have found to know where people are or exactly when they've come and gone that are more effective than we have in the United States?
In general, the European Union, which allows people to move around within it without restriction, does have somewhat better controls on at least better keeping track of entry, exit. But they, too, face many of the same challenges and problems. We have the problem of Albanian illegal immigration to Italy and to the rest of Europe and so on. So we're not the only ones facing this situation. The scale is greater. Obviously, we have more people coming in than any other country, more people going out, massive land borders in which there are about 300 million non-citizens who cross our borders every year. Now, that's a lot of commuters and so forth.
Jake Tapper?
Well, in Great Britain has a lot of problems like this. Great Britain is known as a place where a lot of, for instance, individuals, there's one of the imams who has actually been sentenced to death in Jordan, lives in England because England will not, like a lot of European countries, will not turn over criminals wanted in other countries if they are wanted under the death penalty. They're quite punishable by death because England, like a lot of most European countries, does not believe in the death penalty. So England is the receptacle for a lot of individuals, a lot of Islamic extremists and others from all over the world. That said, let's also point out that none of these the alleged hijackers or the terrorists from September 11th came in from Mexico. They did come. Some of them did come in, however, from Canada, which obviously has a lot of the same standards when it comes to immigration as England, their homeland. And the bomber that was caught crossing the border for the millennial celebration, that was one of the few customs, INS, FBI, law enforcement successes in preventing terrorism in December 1999, was caught coming in to the United States in Washington State from Canada. And that's a place where people are talking about shoring up Border Patrol much more so than they are shoring up Border Patrol in the Rio Grande.
The border that we think of as leafy and pastoral and relatively non-threatening, but it hasn't turned out that way lately. Stephen Camerata, we've just got a few seconds left. Next big legislative proposals likely to be on the table in just 30 seconds?
the entry exit system, machine readable visas with with biometrics, you know, fingerprints, photos, and I think those are the two things that we're going to see a lot of, more border patrol as well, and also tracking for students and temporary workers. Dianne Feinstein and Kit Bond's bills have a lot of that in it, and it looks like the president is willing to sign off on a lot of that.
Much more to come. Stephen Camerata, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jake Tapper, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Jake Tapper's Washington correspondent for Salon.com magazine. Stephen Camerata is director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. You can continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, alone in an ivory tower. Heated debates about the war on terror are taking place on the nation's college campuses. Michael Fink teaches liberal arts at the Rhode Island School of Design. He says his colleagues seem unified in their dissent, and he feels alone in his support of American military action.
I've been teaching at the Rhode Island School of Design since 1957. The campus feels like my home, but I never felt so alone on campus as I did during the professor-student forum that followed the September 11th attacks on Manhattan and D.C. My colleagues were having a grand time agreeing with students that America must have been doing something very wrong to merit such hatred winging its way toward our towers. There was a lot of self-congratulation circulating around the auditorium. Twin mics had been set up for the pacifist protest against U.S. policies worldwide. I guess I'm getting old. I was a kid listening to the parlor radio and staring back and forth from the glowing tubes on the zenith to the flames on our hearth that Sunday evening in December 1941, on the eve of my seventh birthday, when war was declared. When my uncles and older cousins went off over the oceans to the battlefields and came back dazzling with medals, one on crutches and with a purple heart, they were my heroes. I remember the day that the State of Israel was declared, and popular tunes celebrated the victory of the victims. Israel came into being not because of the USA or because of the Soviet Union, but because the survivors of the camps took both plowshares and pistols into their own hands and the lands of their ancestors. But the mood at our departmental meetings in the wake of the rally was one of apparent unity. Everybody felt we had made a wise and responsible choice to blame ourselves for our troubles. As for me, I felt precisely the opposite. This is a time for healthy anger against our enemies and for pride in our own traditions. What the terrorists destroyed at the World Trade Center was not some symbol of Western power, but the sight of human beings from here, there, and everywhere, come to work to build their lives with their neckties and necklaces on, and their hopes high for a good day in the gorgeous autumn weather, under a safe azure sky. Suddenly, on September 11th, at the start of our semester, Gotham became not stone, but spirit. I had celebrated an elderly uncle's late marriage at the Windows on the World, and again the couple's fifth anniversary there, gazing out the glass vista at the lights and the Statue of Liberty in the harbor. I cannot see my homeland as an oppressor nation, but as a refuge for the oppressed. I recently made my own pilgrimage to Manhattan. People were wearing red, white, and blue, and it did not at all strike me as mindless or empty flag waving. It was a phoenix mood, a mixture of cheer and melancholy. A city brought tightly together like a family, afraid perhaps, but uplifted by confidence in New York life, in American destiny, made manifest by the banner of stars and stripes that brought me back to my childhood. I never felt so isolated as I did at the campus gathering, and as I do in an ivory tower that threatens to trivialize us and separate our students from our people, who are deeper and closer to the truth than the fanciest academics, and whose instincts as people and citizens hit the mark more accurately than all the historians and scholars put together and strung out at their mics, preaching defeat and disdain.
Michael Fink lives in Providence, Rhode Island. How has our changing world changed you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. Transcripts of the radio diaries featured on our special coverage are now available at the website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.